Could everyone make sure that their phones, all phones, are completely off? Not just partially off. Okay, Alex, you ready?
Okay, the mentoring imperative, if you don't spend time to mentor your people, your team will not develop the capacity to achieve breakthrough goals. Mentoring is tough. It's very messy. Mothers, have you seen a one-year-old child try to feed himself or herself? Yes, what does it look like? Messy. And what does the good mother do? Well, yeah, but does the mother start feeding the baby herself or just allows her to? Yeah, but the mom just suffers the mess so that the baby will learn. And if you don't, the picture will be like this. Your son will be 35 years old, and you're bringing his food to his office, and you're going to have to feed him because he doesn't know how to feed himself. Now, as gross as that looks, that's what happens when people are not mentored, okay? Mentoring has to do with suffering the mess. And when you ask somebody to do something and you think he or she is half qualified, suffer the mess. It doesn't have to be perfect because people will not learn until they fail. By the way, only failure teaches. Success just bloats up your ego. Many manager leaders do not mentor because they don't want to suffer the mess of a less than perfect output. But you need to, because if you don't, if your people don't grow, if your team does not grow, your team will not achieve breakthrough goals. You will fall into what I call the gap trap. What is the gap trap? It goes like this. On the vertical axis is goals. On the horizontal axis is time. I have a 3-year time frame. The solid line there is the competency level of your team. It's flat because this manager has not mentored. So the learning curve is flat. They don't learn. So year one, the goal is higher than the competency level of the team. There's a gap. The goal is here. The capacity is here. Who fills in the gap? Who fills the gap? The manager, the leader, of course. So you do. And your boss says, you know what? I knew I could depend on you. So here's next year's goal. And there's something funny about goals. In business, they're always higher than the prior year. Why is that? I used to tell my boss, and he would laugh. I said, boss, can't we take a vacation? Can't we have lower goals for next year? He said, no. So the gap is even bigger. Who fills in the gap? Because you're not mentoring. Who fills in the gap? You. Two things are happening. You're beginning to enjoy this. You're the savior. You're the hero. Worse, your team is beginning to getting used to depending on you. Now, I'm so glad our boss is great. He always bails us out. Well, guess what? Year three, the goal is even higher. And that learning curve is flat. You have not mentored your people. Well, who fills in the gap? Maybe the leader. Or maybe it's your replacement. Because by now you've burnt out. You have hit the wall. Your marriage is shut. Your children don't know you. You come home and they ask their mom, who is that? You've hit the wall. You've fallen into the gap trap. You cannot do it. Unless you mentor your people, okay? Someone tried to do it, and he burnt out. He brought his wife out to dinner, and this is what happens. Look at the video. You can drink gallons of that tea. It's not going to help you. When you fall into the gap trap, you're dead, okay? The mentoring principles, you are the model. If you do not continue to develop and grow, no one below you will. Maxwell calls this the law of the lid. It's very graphic. The lid means tuck it, correct? You are the model. You are the leader. You are the lid. People below you are not going to rise if the lid does not go up. As a matter of fact, if the lid does not rise, people below you who want to get ahead would want to come out from under you and be led by other people. Okay? So, If you want to mentor people, understand you are the model. You can't model what you don't have or what you don't do. Because people do what people see. It's easier to teach what is right than to do what is right. What's wrong with this picture? Son, I don't want you to smoke, you know, because this nicotine thing, this is bad. So what's wrong with that picture? You know, you don't have to worry, parents, about what your children will do. You don't have to worry what to teach your children. They will do as you do. Let me repeat. Because of the principle of modeling. Okay? The idea is, you know, if this is clay and I have a signet ring, I press it, and modeling, it leaves an impression. All right? It's what you do that your children will do. It's what you do that your disciples will do. It's what you do that your team members will do. It's not what you say. Okay? You can't say, don't do as I do as I say. Yeah, they'll do as you do. The children of alcoholics, they hate alcoholism. They hate their alcoholic father or mother. And yet, if there is no divine intervention, apart from divine intervention, they too become alcoholics because of the modeling principle. Okay? People will do as you do. So when you begin to mentor, remember you are the model. We wanted our kids to learn how to play the piano when they're small, 6 to 8. So Mark and Paolo, they became good piano players. And Paolo, the guy in Fordham, is an accomplished musician. He has a bass guitar, he has a saxophone, he can play the piano. He is a fantastic guitarist. He would play a piece on the CD, and then he would be in front of it, and I thought he was trying to follow it. He was providing a counterpoint, and I said, wow, this kid is something. You know, but I could never ask him to play when there were guests. Lalang. Don't ever ask him to play when there are guests. You know, his music is for him. And if you happen to be passing by, you can enjoy it. But that's it. Anyway, when Jody and Stephanie, the two younger kids from the same wife, by the way, two sets of kids. I have a 36 and 34, and then I have a 26 and 24. Okay? Same wife. In the U.S., you have to explain this. Because when I went to Stanford and I told them I had two sets of kids, they said, oh, of course, you know. Everybody assumed I got divorced and remarried. I said, no, it's the same wife. Oh, but did you split and you came together again? No, it's the same wife. Because in the break, in the semester in Stanford, people came in with their second wives. And these are 55-year-old kids with toddlers, the men with toddlers. I said, what happened? It's my second wife. Half of the class was like that. So I had to explain. So anyway. When the two younger kids were 6 and 8, I said, okay, time for piano. We don't want to go to piano. I said, after piano, we go to McDo. Okay. Well, what happens when you incentivize people that way? After 2 weeks, it no longer works. Right. So they go to their mom, and they said, you know, mom, how come dad always wants us to play piano? He naman is not playing piano. And so my wife loves me and is very protective of my golf. I was still working then. I expected her to say, look, your dad works all week and Saturday is his golf game, so don't bother him. You go to piano yourself. Instead, she looks at me and she says, oh, nga naman. So what do you mean? So picture this. I am 45 years old. I am in my golf gear. But under my arm is my piano piece. Behind me is 8-year-old Jody with his piano piece. And behind him is 6-year-old Stephanie with her piano piece. And we are marching to the Alabang Town Center music school. My wife said, if you don't model it, they're not going to do it. So I told my teacher was 19 years old. I had my cubicle, Jody had his cubicle, and Stephanie had her cubicle. And I told my teacher, I proceeded to terrorize her right away. I said, look, Don't give me a hard time. I'm just here for the kids. Yes, sir. So we start. Old MacDonald had a, you know. 2 years. 2 years, I learned nothing. Oh, by the way, the deal with the school was no recitals. Okay, under no condition will I have a recital. I don't care if I don't get a certificate. I just need my kids to play the piano. So Jody and Steph can play the piano today because of my modeling, no matter how insincere the modeling is. You see, no matter how poor the modeling was, it was still modeling. Okay. Values are caught, they are not taught. You've heard that, right? You can't talk values. You have to demonstrate. Joe.
Well, first I'm wondering if I want my kids to have to learn the piano now in the future. But still thinking about the gap trap, you said something about how in business, goals are automatically bigger the next year. I think for us in a church, since we don't have that automatic drive, because we won't be out of business if our goals aren't bigger, the temptation, knowing that if we don't mentor, it stays flat, is to keep the goals the same or even lower them, because it would be unrealistic for me to give more time as a leader. It would be unrealistic for me to devote more. Not realizing that probably the most strategic thing, instead of driving straight into reaching that goal, is to lifting the level of the people. Because to me now, I'm thinking, how can I lift the level of all of our people? That way, I mean, the goal will hit itself. You know what I mean? Like,
the goal is to make people make disciples who will make disciples. Okay? And it's especially in campus ministry. Okay? You lose them after they graduate. So if you don't continue to do it, that's what I mean. And the goal is to perpetuate that system so that you leave a legacy, even if you yourself graduate, it's ongoing. Okay? So it's not a good analogy for ministry, but the thing is, if your people do not learn how to set up a discipleship-making system in their campuses that will perpetuate itself, you may not be increasing disciples, but you could lose the discipleship-making activity immediately. So that's the... All right, good point. So, exercise. I'll give you 2 minutes. List down what you do you want your people to copy or to emulate. List down what you do that you don't want your people to copy or to emulate. Okay? Ready? Go. By the way, your people see you. So don't think they don't see what you do. If you don't want the music, just raise your hand and we'll kill it. Okay. Ayaw daw, patay mo na. All right, time's up. You can continue that at home. In fact, you could continue that. What things do? You don't want your children to copy. What things do you do that you want your children to copy? Okay, continuing on. Mentor, coach, then empower your people. The Procter & Gamble 4-step sales training cycle. Okay. Mentoring is about how to win in life. Coaching is how to develop skills. Okay, so that's how I distinguish it. And so the P&G 4-step sales training cycle, this is on skills development. And I went through this in 1972 as a sales trainee. They will give you a lecture in the office, okay, the coordinated planned sales call, how to make a sales call. I'm in marketing, but you need to go to sales training to advance. So my trainer is giving me a lecture in the office, and then he said, okay, Alex, let's go to the field. They actually pull a salesman out, and I'm driving a Ford 350. I mean, this is a truck. The cab is separate from the body with a huge tide on the side, all right? And so My trainer told me, all right, it's my first ever sales call in my whole life. He said, okay, we have 15 calls to make today. I will do the first three calls. You observe me, I do it, you observe me. And then you do it, I observe you. Okay? So we proceed, and he goes through the basics, and I'm watching him. He comes back. We go back to the truck. He said, did you see what I did? Yes. Okay, I'll do two more. So he does two more. After that, he says, okay, Alex, you do it. And I was very terrified. And so I did it. But as you can imagine, I made a mockery of the coordinated blank call because I was just too nervous. But Nolly, my trainer, I remember very clearly, he did not intervene. We come back to the truck, and that's when he said, look, you present as if you're a helper. You don't have the confidence. You have to have confidence. You're bringing business. So I do it again. And then he gives me feedback again. What I learned about that is this. Nolly, the expert sales trainer, did not intervene. He suffered the mess. He didn't care if the store owner was thinking very badly about Procter & Gamble. What a lousy company this is to give me a salesman like this. Or how his reputation might look like because his apprentice was a lousy one. He did not intervene. And so through the humiliation, through the embarrassment, I learned. After three calls, believe it or not, I became very confident. So we went to the third stage. He said, okay, you do it. I leave you. I'm going to empower you. By the seventh call, I was no longer nervous because he mentored me. He allowed me to go through the difficulty, the failure, and I learned. Of course, if I stayed in the sales department, pretty soon I would be seasoned enough to be a trainer. And is it familiar? This is discipleship, correct? Okay. So the presumption is you know what you're teaching. You cannot coach if you don't have the expertise on the subject yourself. The key things to remember is to provide a safe environment as the coach does it on his or her own, and be vulnerable about your own difficulties, because if you are open about your own failures, the apprentice will be encouraged. He or she will say, there is hope for me. Because if my trainer was struggling himself or herself, there is hope for me. Number two, you will come across as a human being, that you don't walk on water. And so it will be an encouragement to the apprentice. And then give feedback about the progress. Okay, the coaching logic. Focus on strengths and not weaknesses. You know this. We contribute based on our strengths. Focusing on weaknesses is very inefficient and futile, in fact. Manage weaknesses, don't attempt to improve on them. It's easier, far more productive to enhance your strengths than to improve on your weaknesses. I love golf. But compared to Tiger Woods, even if I spend the rest of my life playing golf, I will never make it there. On the other hand, if I can just tighten up my facilitation technique and tighten up my message development technique, I can improve dramatically my teaching style. So, because if I focus on my weakness, I'm going to waste my time. Okay. I manage my weakness, and we should manage our weaknesses by building complementary strengths through the composition of our team. Okay, I'm weak in math. I failed in math. I'll tell you a story later if we have time. I think the word is I'm a disaster in math. but it was emotional, and my late brother taught me calculus, and it was remarkable. He told me, Alex, math is a language. And if you just understand the meaning of the symbols, you'll get it. Because he said, you're not dumb. You're just, I don't know what's wrong with you. So I surrounded myself as a manager with management engineers. I mean, the marketing director, Willie, is BS math. One of my marketing managers is magna cum laude, management engineering. The head of accounting was, I thought she was magna cum laude until she said, excuse me, sir, I'm summa cum laude. Oh, sorry. Her name is Emily. She was a summa cum laude, for crying out loud, in accounting, a board top notcher. So I surrounded myself to cover for my weakness. I didn't bother trying to improve my weakness, okay? And neither should you. It's a waste of time. Now, listen carefully. As you know, God is not hostage to your strengths. God does not need your strengths to accomplish his purposes. So even though you focus on your strengths, remind yourself, ultimately, you depend on God. Because God is not hostage to your strengths. God can use even your weaknesses to accomplish his purposes. The key is having the humility to allow for accurate assessment of strengths and weaknesses, and also having a mindset that everyone has a strength. Okay? We are not wired to see the strengths in people. We are wired to see their faults. So we have a one-minute exercise. Get a partner, the one beside you better, so we don't waste time moving around, okay? Get a partner. This is 1 minute only. You can't do it threesome. Just go to the nearest person, okay? Everybody has a partner? 1 minute only. You cannot talk. You cannot ask a question. Listen carefully. Come on, help. Get a partner. Okay, instructions. The setup will take longer than the test itself because you only have 1 minute. Grab a chair. Come on. Okay. You can't talk. You can only look at your partner and write down as many things as you can. Write it down in your piece of paper. As many things as you can about your partner. As long as it is positive, I don't care what you write. You cannot write anything that's negative. If you know your partner, write about him or her character. Write about him or her physically. Write anything, but it must be positive. All right? You cannot write anything negative. 1 minute. Are you ready? Go. You can't talk, but you have to look at your partner. You can giggle, it's okay. Time's up. Time's up. Okay? I want you to exchange papers. Exchange papers. And discover what your partner said about you. Okay? Just read it. 1 minute, 1 minute. What did you find out about that exercise? How was that? What did you find out about it? What's that experience like? Nice? What did you feel? Oh, did your partner say nice things about you? Okay. Was he or she accurate? Got you there, didn't I, huh? Yes, okay. So how did that feel? How did you feel? Huh?
I didn't know that she thinks of me that way.
Wow, okay, feels good. I didn't know she, what about you?
Yeah, I felt happy and just the whole of my self-affirmation.
All right. You're good for 6 months, right? Okay. Who else? How did that feel? Reactions. Yes, Joe.
I was thinking, why am I only doing this now? Because like I was writing for Robert, and I thought, I've never said, I might have said some of them to him, but I've never said a lot of them to him.
Excellent.
And I thought like of everybody else who I work with, when I'm like, why haven't I said this to any of them?
So, yep. Daniel.
Microphone. I never thought. Yeah, I got it. Beeper. No, just kidding. And I never thought that Glenn would see that those things as my strength, because sometimes I see it as, you know, it's wonderful. Not a strength, but
okay. Yeah. So you're surprised that you are projecting that strength to other people that you yourself did not know. Very nice. Anyone else? Yes. Pinky.
It was easier for me because I sat down with someone I don't just work with, but someone I know personally. And I realized it will be easier for us to really see the strengths in people if we get to know them. Like going back to the previous topic, if we spend time getting to know them beyond work, then it just flows. So it's easier to take them through seasons in life where they could walk out in their strengths.
Very good. For all you know, you have a genius in your team. For all you know, you have a tremendous leader in your team who's just too shy and inward looking. You know, you got to bring this home and do it for each of your children and your spouse. Because, you know, they put a tape recorder on two-year-olds. On many two-year-olds as a research project to see what two-year-olds hear all day. 80% was negative. Wow. No, don't, stop, bad. And we wonder why people grow up cynical. So you ask yourself the question. I mean, if you look at your wife, are you an affirming husband? Or if you look at your husband, are you an affirming wife? Or is it, oh, you got another man? That's such a downer. Are you got another man? What do you mean? I mean, is that my career? You know, ikaw talaga. And it's such a downer. And you know what? It takes Herculean effort and intentionality to be positive. Because all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. I mean, we just love to be negative. It takes a lot of effort and intentionality to be positive. And you know what? If you want to win people to the Lord, be an affirming person. And you will be amazed at how many people want to spend time with you. And how you can be influential in bringing them to Christ. It doesn't matter if you're excellent in Bible teaching, if you're lousy in relating. You're not going to win a lot of souls. Okay. Let me just repeat. God is not hostage to our strengths. In fact, our strengths can deter us from trusting in Christ. We must cultivate our strengths, but teach dependence on God to harness our strengths. God created you for your strengths, but He does not want you to depend on your strengths. You must learn to go beyond yourself and say, Lord, I am incompetent apart from you. Yeah. I can do nothing without you. In fact, I am nothing without you. Yeah. So will you help me? And your strengths become a gift. It becomes a spiritual instrument in God's hands. And it will accomplish things beyond what you think your strengths can do. Okay. The challenge of empowerment. Why do many leaders not empower their people? They feel their jobs are threatened, they have low self-esteem, they resist change, and they have not mentored their people well. The principle is this: only secure leaders will give power to others. The principle of empowerment goes like this: if I have 100% authority to empower Mitch, I have to give 10% of my authority to Mitch, and how much is left to me? 90%. An empowering leader has to be so secure because you actually diminish your power because you will give it to somebody else. That takes a lot of character and faith, okay? And we are in a faith-based work, but many times we are not, we don't have the faith to do it. Empowerment implies a voluntary reduction in your power to give it to others. If I develop my people, I become dispensable. Okay? I don't know why people are insecure about developing people. People say, Alex, eh, pag dinevelop ko yung mga, hindi tanggal ako. I mean, are you crazy? There are so few people who develop leaders that when you become a leader producer, if you are a person who produces leaders, you become so precious to the organization. Because the world is thirsting for leaders who can reproduce themselves. I keep telling people in the corporate world, you know, when you are a developer of leaders, whether your company sees it or not, your industry will see it. In fact, any industry will see it. And if you're a good leader, you will be in demand. You will never want for a job. Okay, so that's a myth that we need to bust very quickly. By the way, the truth is you are dispensable. No one is indispensable. Okay, but if you are a developer of leaders, you actually become a more precious asset to your organization. At the root of it, however, is self-esteem. So let's deal with self-esteem. The definition of self-esteem is this. I gain self-esteem when someone who is significant to me loves me unconditionally. Okay? Repeat. Self-esteem is when someone who is significant to me loves me unconditionally. So if you love me but you're not significant to me, that's not going to build my self-esteem. You must be significant to me and you must love me for who I am, unconditionally. Of course, we know the root of that. God is the most significant person in the universe. And we know, John 3:16, He loves us unconditionally. That is the source and bedrock of our self-esteem. Okay? But somehow, managers and leaders get into a self-esteem issue. Sometimes it's because they have compartmentalized their work life from their Christian life. And you can't compartmentalize. You got to break the barriers. And you have to be the same person at work, at home, on the street, in church, and everywhere else in between. Okay? And I tell people, the best way to develop self-esteem is to cultivate that vertical relationship every day. The more you know God, the more you say, you know, there's something funny about God. You know, He is so great, and yet He loves me. As in, totally. He is so good. You know, I've developed a wonderful habit, and it's really helping me. I realize the more I know about God's Word, the more I will know Him. And so what I've done, shame on me, I should have done this a lot earlier, is to begin to memorize passages. Because I realize reading is one thing, but to meditate on God's Word, if you memorize it and you repeat it again and again, it goes deep into you. And something that you've known a long time, a passage you've known a long time, gives you a fresh insight into the heart of God, and it just builds me up. It just builds me up. Where do kids get their self-esteem? Parents. Okay, you're new mother. You're up late because there's a presentation tomorrow. In fact, you're not finished. You have to bring homework. And you remember you have a baby girl at home. So you kind of put her to bed, and then you resume your PowerPoint presentation. You're finished at 1 o'clock in the morning, and the meeting is at 8, and it's with Paul. You dare not be late. And so And so you take a quick shower. You're in bed at 1:30. You're probably asleep at 1:31. Okay? Because it's your first baby, the crib is inside the master's bedroom. At about 2:15 in the morning, your baby decides she's hungry. And of course, we know what they do, right? They ask permission. Mommy, can I wake you up? Is that what they do? No, they couldn't care less. They just cry. Okay? And they couldn't care less that you had to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning to make your 8 a.m. meeting. And they couldn't care less that you just had 45 minutes of sleep. They cry. What does the good mother do? Oh, come on. You kick the husband and you tell him it's his turn, right? Let's say it's your turn. It's your turn. It's not your husband's turn. So you get up. Now, you're a manager. There's a problem. There's noise. And you want to go back to sleep. So you're going to fix this, right? So you proceed to strangle your baby. Is that what you do? No. Okay, you use a pillow. No? No, okay. And in fact, you get the baby. Baby. Okay? She's wet. She's not wet. You feed. She's finished. You burp. You can tell I've done this, right? And then you lay her back. Make sure everything is okay. And you wait for those little eyes to close again. And then you go back to sleep. And when you go back to sleep, you know what? There's not 1 ounce of anger or bitterness in your heart. You know why? It's called unconditional love. And that's how these little kids, when they wake up in the morning, through the bars of their crib, they say, you know that big boy there? That's my dad. And he likes me. That big girl there, that's my mom. She likes me even more. And that's how self-esteem is developed. Okay? Right. What if parents blow it? As many do. What if your father ran away? What if your mother ran away when you were 2? What if your father and mother ran away when you were 2? What if your mom is a career woman and your dad is an OFW? Which was my life. I was the son of the original OFW. It wasn't Middle East. It was Guam and Saipan and Marianas Island. I saw my father once a year for 45 years. From the age of 11 until he died. He spent 40 years in Guam. Now, I have no idea where I got my self-esteem. My mother loved me. But you know what? When I met the Lord, I said, that's it. Yeah. I was flooded with self-esteem, and self-esteem came oozing out of my ears. And the biggest surprise to me is how come through all of this, I have not developed an insecurity. I used to be very insecure. First semester in Ateneo, I grew up in the province, so I was so intimidated by all of these people in Ateneo. I mean, how can they speak so good English, you know? So the first semester in class, I did not speak one whole semester. You will not hear one word from me. If you did not bump into me, you wouldn't think I was there because I was so insecure. You know, until I passed my tests in the first semester, and I said, hey, I can make it here. And I began to come out of my shell. But you know what? If you want to be an effective people manager, you have to check your self-esteem. In fact, you have to check the source of your self-esteem. It had better be God himself. And by the way, he's the only real source of self-esteem. The most significant person in the universe loves me unconditionally. And because you need that to be able to empower people. Because if you don't, the consequences of a lack of empowerment is like this. I have a prop. You know, if you are, I hope you can see this. If you are not very secure, what's going to happen is the people, if you don't empower people, your followers will not grow. They will be organizational retards. And because of the principle of modeling, when they mentor people, they will follow your style. They will also not empower. When the third generation picks it up, they say, oh, life is very simple in this organization. Just obey, and you'll be fine. Pretty soon, your non-empowering leadership style will beget a legacy of dwarfs. And the whole organization implodes on the collective insecurity of its leaders. Wow. You know what? I see organizations like this. You go to any typical, there are exceptional, but any typical government bureaucracy. You ask for help. Somebody says, I'm not in charge of that. Go there. You go here. Oh, he says, okay, you go there. Oh, and they pass you from one table to another. A, no one knows what they're supposed to do. B, if they did, they're not empowered to do it. I would rather that we were this guy. And when we manage our people, we are so nurturing and empowering, and we don't care if they become bigger than us. And they will pick up on that style and mentor and disciple their people the same way, such that in time we will beget a legacy of giants. And you could not stop this organization if you tried. Okay? By the way, I see this in Victory. And I am so pleased. This is feedback to you guys. I'm a relative outsider. But I see a lot of empowerment here, regardless of what you actually feel. But there's a lot of empowerment here. And that's why it's bursting at the seams. I mean, a missionary growth factor of fourfold in 5 years. That's amazing. That's unheard of. No other church does that. Campus missionaries surpassing that of Campus Crusade. Are you crazy? I think it's totally. You know, I failed in math in grade 5. We were in Pakistan. My father got a contract where you could bring your family, his OFW contract. So the only family I knew was between the age of 9 and 11. Where I went home, there was a father, a mother, and siblings eating at the same table. That's the only family I know for 2 years. So that's not bad. But I was so emotionally maladjusted, I could not understand anything. There was a brand new De La Salle High School. And I was okay in the other subjects, but math, my dad said, look, I'm an engineer. And my uncles were accountants. And my brother grew up to become a mechanical engineer. He said, it's not in our DNA to be weak in math. But when we went to school, my teacher was so disappointed with me, he did not give me an F. He gave me 3 zeros and told my father, there's something wrong with your son. And my father said, what kind of grading system is this? I mean, if you put a 1, it'll be 1,000. But it's 3 zeros. This is a true story, 3 zeros. And I was grounded for life. My father said, you are not going out until you learn math. They got me a tutor, and well, I passed, okay? But the stigma never left me. As far as I'm concerned, I'm mathematically challenged. I went to Ateneo. For crying out loud, I enrolled in economics. Because I didn't know any better. And I found there's so much math in economics. And I told my brother, Toto, you got to help me. And he was a mechanical engineer student in De La Salle. And so that's when he taught me math as a language. Right. And I got it. And I got it. But you know, the stigma never left me. And so when I had the authority to hire and fire people, I hired people who were bigger than me. My response to my insecurity was to manage it by hiring people. If there's a joke in Del Monte, if you had an IQ test of the board, the president and the executive committee, I'd get the lowest grade. Because I surrounded myself with super bright people in guess what subject? Math. Okay? And you know what? I nurtured them. And I didn't care if they grew bigger than me. Okay? But we're like this. You see. So, how empowering a leader are you? Before lunch, do that survey. 1 minute. Go. Okay.
That it?
That it.
1:30. 1:30. See y'all.